You go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other, they pay each other, they buy houses, they get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow, you're a real anarchist.
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Welcome, welcome. This is the Three Left Show live from Grand Street Community Arts. I'm your host, Dan Platt. This is the Three Left Show, multi-tenancy program covering issues from a far left-wing perspective. I'm not in a great place right now, emotionally, I guess. I'm between jobs, so to speak. Oh, usually when you say you're between jobs, it means you're like employed. What I mean is I'm going from one type of job to a different type of job, and I'm kind of juggling the scheduling. And so for the foreseeable future, at least till the end of the year, I'm only going to do one show every other week. So although I think there'll be two shows in a row because I'll actually have a guest lined up. But I do have for the first hour a number of environmentally, the theme of ecology, the three lefts are three flags. One is anarchism, one is socialism, one is ecology. If the little intro montage maybe gave you some hints. So, and it's been a while since I've covered ecology news, or particularly news that is obviously revolutionary or radical in nature in terms of tone and how I analyze things, but also has the bent of the environment, our planet, of which our economy is, in fact, in our very lives are based on. So a fight for the environment is a fight for our lives, as the people in Flint can tell you, as the people in any impacted community, usually poor and black, brown, etc. Because pollution is put where the least can one cannot afford to fight back unless you organize and get help from middle-class people, from allies and such, and build coalitions. So, where to start? I think I'll start with the better news. Part of a conversation I had, I went to a local sustainability meetup this week, just last night, and it was some good people talking about like how much more activism some of them could do. I pretty much had them beat because I already do a lot of activism. It's not a contest, though. It's not a race. And it's not competitive. It's about being collaborative, giving them ideas. And one idea that she said, like, oh, I'm interested in agroforestry. And that's interesting because I was just about to do a story on agroforestry, which is the kind of, but my thought was that agroforestry is the commercial name for permaculture. So I suppose I should define what that is, which is the general idea and practice of gardening like it matters. Having multiple types of plants and arrangements of plants and a way of working with your inputs like compost and dirt and what have you, and outputs, what you're creating with each plant, and make everything work together. So usually when you have conventional farming, agribusiness, you know, and agro is the particular modifier to the word, is monoculture, meaning it's all one type of plant. You know, you have a field of corn, which means, and it's only one species of corn, one genus, one particular type of corn, which makes it all more susceptible to disease, pests, and everything else, which means in order to fight back against that, you need to spray it with industrial chemicals, some of which are harmful, especially if not in the long run. Part of GMO is making the plants more susceptible to stronger petrochemicals, like, you know, the pesticides and the herbicides, you know, weed killers and stuff, which then go into the aquifers and kill everything, or at least very, very slowly. So permaculture is a way of transitioning to, it's not just a matter of organic, you know, because you can have organic farms that are still very industrial in character, and thus why the price is up. But permaculture is about managing your resources in a way that you basically have, it's a closed system, as it were. So maybe you need to start by getting some, importing some mulch and fertilizer. But otherwise, once you get going, it's all like you include animals. So basically, which are, you know, scat factories, and they basically fertilize the ground. You don't have to eat them. They're not about eating them, but it's about having them around so that they are managing the landscape for you. You don't have to mow it. You know, maybe you've heard of a goat service that you rent a goat and the goat eats your lawn, so you don't have to mow it. So going into the story here, agroforestry may be a new weapon in climate change fight. This is from a site called Futurity. Oh, that's a mouthful of a name. It kind of has a techno-futurist tone to it, as it is using the word agroforestry. I think it's a matter of culture of, you know, if you're coming from the top down, this is seeing things from, and it's also quoting like how it's better for as far as carbon impact. But permaculture does so much more. And also looks at it as far as, and also in terms of making farms more profitable. So I'm just going to start reading. An agricultural system that combines trees with crops and livestock on the same plot of land, agroforestry, is especially popular in developing countries because it allows small shareholder farmers who have little very land available to maximize what they have. They can plant vegetables and grain crops around the trees that produce fruit and nuts and also wood that they use for fuel. And trees provide shade for the animals that provide milk and meat. The researchers analyzed data from 53 published studies, so usually called a meta-study, around the world and tracked changes in soil organic carbon after land conversion from forest to crop cultivation and pasture grassland to agroforestry. So meaning, you know, chop down a forest and just clear-cut the land, which is basically what's happening in the Amazon completely. Half of the Amazon's gone from clear-cutting. It's really terrible for everything. While forests sequester about, and sequestering means like how much carbon does it hold. More carbon released, the hotter the plant's going to get. While forests sequester about 25% more carbon than any other land use, agroforestry on average stores even more than regular agriculture. The transition from agricultural agroforestry significantly increased the soil organic carbon, how much carbon is in the dirt, how good the dirt is, particularly. An average of 34%. These stats can be rather not very meaningful to the layman. We showed that agroforestry systems play an effective role in global carbon sequestration. So, like, it's coming at it from fighting climate change, as the title suggests. I can also speak to the social, because this is what, it, just talking about agroforestry, right, from a commercial sense and from a top-down, what is the carbon sequestration rate of switching to this? There's also the social aspects of not having industrial production, having people work with the land more directly. It's more social. It's working with nature. One example of permaculture in action is you don't need to spray with pesticides, because what you do is you plant certain plants that attract the predators of insects next to the plants that you don't want insects touching. And there are certain plants that certain bugs don't like being near. So you plant a certain ivy around your tomatoes, and these type of caterpillars and stuff won't go near your tomatoes. And the same goes for flies. You know, you plant some things that attract wasps, and the wasps kill the flies, and so on and so on. It's like having a cat around, and that keeps the mice away. There's an evidence that forests are great storages of carbon compared to agricultural systems. No, duh. Government programs in some countries in the tropics, like Brazil, Indonesia, and Kenya, are paying farmers to grow trees on their land to mitigate climate change. Every tree counts. I'm sure you're aware of any Arbor Day propaganda. Jacobson points out, and that strategy is widely embraced because farming systems are much more integrated in the tropics where farmers are poorer. But of course, that's like saying, okay, they're poor and in the developing world, so we can keep having our industrial food production and no problems occur, right? Oh no, spike in cancer rates, soil degradation, we basically have another 30 years of good harvest left, and then we basically destroyed our agriculture economy. Yes, that is going to be the case. That's how much longer we can have industrial food production. So, you know, don't expect to retire and there would be like the same selection of produce. And the, you know, it irks me when people kind of complain about, oh, you don't have this type of tropical fruit available right now. Like, no, none of it is grown locally. You know, it's a special thing when we have food and produce out that's actually grown in the region. And it's not that it's more expensive. It doesn't have to be. In fact, it's probably can be cheaper. It's just a matter of the economics. And the economic system does not support local farming. I mean, we would still have a robust farming sector here in our area as well as anyone else's if it weren't for the drivers of competition, consolidation, monopoly. You know, now we have an oligarchy of agribusiness. There's like five or so companies that basically own and control, you know, 70-80% of all the farms in America. I mean, and of course that grows each year, so maybe it's even higher. So let's finish this up. Agroforestry and sustainable agriculture share many goals. A high proportion of the watersheds and landscapes in the country are interwoven. Together, they comprise a majority of land use in the U.S. Okay, so he does talk about agroforestry is closely connected to sustainable agriculture movement in the U.S. with its organic, local foods, and permaculture initiatives. Okay, they do mention that word. Permaculture is just like permanent culture, meaning you can farm this way and you can just keep doing it. Unlike agribusiness or conventional farming, where you go to any farmer. If you know one, but if you don't, the usual, you know, things are tough for them and they need government subsidies to be able to survive, and not sell, because they just have to keep getting inputs. They have to buy all the fertilizer. They have to buy, you know, it's more GDP, right? It's more, things they have to buy. That's more money moving around in the economy. So as far as those metrics are concerned, it's good, but it's terrible as far as their livelihoods, their ability to survive and keep producing and produce well, you know, because when you have monoculture, everything just gets worse. The quality of the food, because it's industrial in character, you know, there's no human hands involved. The food has to be tough enough to survive machines, to go through all the machinery, not only to be picked, but to be washed. And so that's particular types of species of your vegetables and produce that get selected. But that makes everything more vulnerable, because if that one, something goes wrong, then the whole crop is gone. And if you didn't know yet, 40% of all food grown gets thrown out. And so it's just total waste. The fact that food is not free, when really it could be, because the input cost is so low. I mean, we just grow so much. But because it's a marketplace, oh, you got to make money. If you can't make money off of the food, then you just throw it out because it's not worth keeping around. It's not worth storing. It's not even worth transporting to the people who are hungry. Because, transportation costs money, right? So, unfortunately, this guy says, there is a tendency to treat agriculture and forestry separately when addressing natural resource concerns. But agroforestry offers a set of conservation and production technologies that can help to integrate forestry. Yeah, so it's just a long form written version of doing things together is more efficient. No doubt, right? But, you know, I'm not going to use the word common sense. I don't like common sense because common sense is like, is it whatever a majority thinks? It's whatever is established over a generation or two as making sense. but lately, over our lifetimes and a few generations now, it is industrial agriculture that has made sense. The ability to grow the scale that we do. But organic farming is trying to show, as they do, that you can also scale up better practices, growing things together, even just alternating rows of crops. You know, does wonders. One example is you have a banana tree, and this is in the tropics too, but you can do the similar thing in America. So you have banana trees and coffee. Coffee grows on bushes because it's a bean. But the coffee bean grows in shade. So you have rows of banana trees that cast shade over the coffee plant. So you just alternate where instead of just having a banana plantation, you basically double your output by also growing coffee. And that's just one example of many examples. Permaculture has a lot of different aspects to it. And I'm still kind of learning through it. I haven't done like the learning course and what have you. You have to travel somewhere. It's not really something you can do online. Time, you have to commit time. It's like going back to school. I always have nightmares about that. Who doesn't? So we still have a few minutes before we take our first break. So I'll just be really quick here because if I don't do it this week, I may not get to it in the future. Maybe the next time. I'm a Green Party guy and I care about the Green Party. Why I think it's worth having an alternative party to vote for in elections that is not for war, for that puts people and planet over profit, that has values, 10 in fact, and sticks to them, you know, having principles, and I think I'll get into that in the next hour as to, you know, the advantages of having principles. I think we can all kind of nod our heads about that. And so I just want to go over some results for the Green Party overall. So I'll start with the bad news here. Ballot Access News, edited by Richard Winger, notes, and this is literally like almost a note, it's just a paragraph here, that minor party and independent candidate votes for the top offices, and this is like governorships, so in governor's races in the latest midterms, were the lowest since 1982. So this suggests that not only third party is not growing, but that third-party voting has actually declined recently. Although the election returns for 08 are far from complete, it is possible to know now that the minor party and independent vote for the top office in each state is only 2.8%. This is the lowest percentage since 82, when it was 1.8%. The highest percentage since World War II was 2010, when it was 5.4%. Top office means most important office. That means governor. There's also Senate races are also considered the top office if there is no gubernatorial election. For the handful of states, so just the remember roll. So that's it. That's the only piece of information which might contradict where the press release I'm going to read from the Green Party itself, Green Party U.S., that the Green Party has achieved ballot status in Massachusetts, which it has not done in a long time. I don't think it's done yet. I think it did it once, but you see, you have to keep getting ballot access every election cycle. Usually, it depends on the state, and that's kind of a problem too. It's not standardized, but some say that's the advantage of having a federation of states. I'll have to agree with that. So the Green Party gained ballot status in Massachusetts and maintained ballot status in Connecticut, D.C., Michigan, New York. Here in New York, Howie Hawkins broke a record by winning ballot line for a third party three consecutive times. The Green Party, though, lost the ballot line in their ballot line in Arizona, Maryland, and Ohio based on the number of votes they got for the governor's race there. These races energized, so this is some spin here. These races, though, energized members, promoted public discussion of our positions, and set the stage for future wins. We kind of say that every time, no matter what the result is. I suppose they need to put out a statement saying, like, what were the actual numbers of active members? Were they more this time or the same than of usual? I know here in our area, it was kind of the same as usual. And sometimes Green Party votes increase suddenly, usually because there's the Democrat, let's say, in the race is disgusting and has some moral failing, and there'll be some breakaway. So we go up to like 5% or something instead of 1 or 2. The highest the Green Party candidate usually for Congress ever gets that I've seen is 15%. This makes sense. Usually minor parties in any other country with a parliamentary system, 15% would actually be pretty good. But here in a winner-take-all system, it's not worth even talking about. So we need ballot access. We need, what is it, ranked choice balloting, and we need all kinds of reforms. These reforms don't happen unless the major parties are forced to, and that's kind of why a position the Green Party should take more often that I overheard at an Election Day party is some elections do need to be spoiled. We're going to spoil elections until the Democrats reform our election system. Because right now, they're letting the Republicans control all of it. You know, the redistricting, the laws, and they can, you know, suppress the vote as they have. In Georgia, in Florida, and anywhere else, they've had their run of it, and Democrats have let them. You know, because they had no problem, because they would think, as long as the Wall Street money's flowing, we can compete. But, you know, elections need to be spoiled, because then they'll start maybe like, okay, fine, ranked choice balloting, and then we can we won't have the spoiler effect anymore, as it were. And the next story on the ecology kick is now talking about waste. But what kind of waste? Well, I talked about food waste last time because it was a farming story. Now I'm going to talk about solar panel waste. So this is from a site called The Verge. The title is "More Solar Panels Mean More Waste, and There's No Easy Solution." It's going to be a major problem by 2050, by Angela Chen. Why 2050? Because solar panels, believe it or not, maybe a misconception, do in fact have a lifespan. Much longer than an average car, let's say, 30 years or so. Now, obviously, much research is into lengthening their lifespan, how long they can go before the electrons stop flowing well. So let's jump into it. Solar panels might be the energy source of the future, but they also create a problem without an easy solution. What to do with the millions of panels when they stop working? On November of 2016, of last year, the Environment Ministry of Japan warned that the country will produce 800,000 tons of solar waste by 2040, and it can't yet handle those volumes. That same year, the International Renewable Energy Agency, good to have that, estimated that there were already 250,000 metric tons of solar panel waste worldwide, and that this number would grow by 78 million by 2050. That is an amazing amount of growth. Obviously, growth in solar power is seen as a complete positive, and I'm with that. But there is always an undecided side effect, especially since when it comes to how solar panel is, you know, it's growing commercially. It's growing as an industrial sector to replace coal and oil burning anyway for power. And that means that, you know, industrial processes create industrial levels of waste. So usually panels are warranted for 25 to 30 years and can last longer if you take care of them. But as the solar industry has grown, the market has been flooded with cheaply made Chinese panels that can break down as few as 5 years, according to Solar Power World editor-in-chief Kelly Pickernickel. To understand the challenges of solar waste, it's helpful to understand how the panels are built. What are panels made of? Well, they're different types, but most are contain aluminum, glass, silver, and an elastic material called ethylene vinyl oxalate. The problem is that they can also contain more dangerous and sometimes carcinogenic, cancer-causing materials like lead, chromium, and cadmium. Functional panels are sealed off with glass and thus, you know, very safe. They don't just leak out carcinogens. Not like volatile organic compounds, VOCs, which are better known to you as new car smell. That's cancer-causing. And they can come off of any new carpet or any kind of certain plastics. So you want to look for a VOC-free label if you can. Let's see. Functional panels are sealed off, but when the glass breaks or the panel is damaged, those substances can leak out. So handle with care if you want to actually fix them, which I know some solar panels are fixable. Like if they get cracked and whatever. And there are ways of upping their efficiency. And there's all kinds of do-it-yourself kind of things, especially if you make your own panels. This risk is especially high with poorly made panels installed in areas that experience extreme weather, hurricane, hail. Winds and rain can also break glass, allowing chemicals to leach in the soil. Well-built panels will, you know, have the assurance that they don't break easy. Because it's always a concern of like, oh, if there's a high wind, will my panels just blow off the roof? But if they're properly installed, no, that, you know, it's all a matter of context. Like, is it made well? Just like anything. In those situations, we have to make sure that we collect the damaged panels in a storm and whatnot, like in Puerto Rico. Like all the solar power that helped Puerto Rico recover is. I covered that in another, some anarchists put some up. Solar panels are just one part of the problem of old electronics, which is now the fastest growing category of waste. China once accepted about 70% of the world's e-waste, but recently it has started refusing to take recycling a couple of years ago. Basically, there are whole towns that are just hellscapes of electronic waste, and it's killing everyone. So China actually wants to, A, focus on its own recycling programs, and yeah, so it stopped taking international waste. For example, companies sometimes sell old but not dead panels to other countries that want them for cheap, but again, that just moves the waste around, such that our system likes doing. While it's far from the only industry struggling to dispose of its waste, there's an extra challenge with solar panels. Recycling isn't economically viable, much like it is for styrofoam, plastic, and all sorts of things. I think only aluminum is really economically viable. That's why cans, you know, you get more for them. I just jumped off. Solar panels do contain some valuable materials like that silver and copper, but not as much as cell phones. And they definitely don't contain enough to make up for the high costs of safely breaking down the panel into parts. As a result, the Electric Power Institute has suggested that storing old panels long-term, like in a landfill, might be the most practical option until the recycling situation's figured out. Just dumping the panels. Maybe neatly into rows, you know, big stacks like the plane boneyards where old planes are just breaking down in the desert. It's really quite amazing to see. Still, the Solar Energy Industries Association, a major industry group, is working with recycling centers in hopes of addressing this problem early. Oh, good for them. 2 years ago, SEIA, acronym, established a national recycling program reaching out to U.S.-based recyclers to vet them and make deals. So I guess they are organized enough to try to work on this. Right now, they're working with 5 recycling centers. 5 in the whole country. Volumes are really low right now, which is both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in that it's good not to have a lot of waste. But not having a lot of waste means traditional recyclers aren't very interested, since it only becomes economical to do it at certain scale. So meaning these 5 recyclers can take all of the solar waste created, but let's say if more than, what is it? Are we at 10% renewables across the country. If we actually went to half as the 20 to 30 plans go, you know, and these are the conservative ones that are just not good enough, because we need to switch to renewables in like 12 years. We have 12 years. I'll get to that in the next section. But we don't really have the time for this. Let the market sort it out. Oh, solar will grow on its own. It will take 50 years. It will be way too late by then. And of course, then there's this added problem of that there'll still be waste, and we still need a whole industry to recycle this stuff. If it can be even recycled, I guess it's possible if there's enough volume of it. So I guess we'll continue here. There are signs that policies are changing. Huntsler mentions that one solution energy policymakers are considering is adding a fee onto the cost of solar panels that would make it easier for them to be removed and recycled. Much like, you know, when you pay the deposit when you buy bottles and glass. Washington State has taken an even more proactive approach. Last year, it passed a law that requires solar panel manufacturers to have a recycling plan in place. Does such a legislation exist for everything else? I don't think that's the case. If not, why not? Of course, the answer why not is obvious. Oh, it's too expensive. You can't, you'll destroy business and so on. Well, you're destroying the goddamn planet. I think we need our priorities straight here. There are all small steps in the right direction, but we still need a comprehensive plan in place before panels shut down. It's all well and good to be excited about promising technology, but we still need to think about what happens after. And this is advice to be taken in by, considered by any techno-utopian, someone who thinks that technology will save us and that we just need the right technology to fix ourselves because humans are broken and only technology can work properly. You know, I think that's the message of Black Mirror, that the technology always works, but it's always the humans that are the problem. Very sardonic, cynical approach to things. Most contemporary sci-fi is. That's why I like any sci-fi that's more optimistic. There's always this waste created with any commodity made in capitalism. And the problem of that even solar panels create waste that needs to be either recycled or reused, but that it takes a lot of resources and energy to do these things. For example, plastics. You know, you recycle plastics, but you're not really recycling the plastic. You're simply, the recycling of plastics are that the plastic is broken down into material, and it can be made into something else. But it can never be actually reused. Like, you don't make the plastic from bottles, and that can be melted down and made into new bottles. Like, once it's melted down, its chemical composition changes, and it has to be used as a different type of plastic that has fewer uses. So the ultimate solution is to not have plastic products, or to have plastic products that are biodegradable, and thus not a matter of a question of recycling it or not. But of course, it's still like creating a waste stream and stuff. You still need to have landfills to put the stuff here. So then it goes that our products, you know, our daily commodities need to last longer. They should not be designed to be disposable. The fact that a bottle, plastic bottle, you know, water, Gatorade, what have you, it's meant to be used once, and that is how it is because the incentives of the marketplace, it is cheapest to do it that way. So as far as the market, it's rational. But as far as the waste that's created and the damage that it does to us and our ecology is not rational. It is not rational at all. As far as humanity is concerned, right? So when I speak of rationality, I'm talking about what is rational for humans and other living creatures generally also. Because if we're talking about, it's assumed that capital, what's rational for capital, money, is what is rational for us, but that we got to get off of that thinking. And this is one example with the solar panels that, you know, we can solve the problem of having our energy sources from renewables. But if we aren't actually using less energy and being more efficient with how we use energy, because it's not so cheap anymore, it's like the goal has always been to make solar as cheap as oil, right? But because oil once upon a time was cheap, that's why all of our buildings don't retain heat and cooling it like well. Like, they have to be, the reason why we have to re-insulate and renovate all our buildings is because they weren't designed to actually be efficient in any way. So, you know, because the energy was so cheap, you could just burn. Burn, maybe burn. And so it's all about living within the means, designing for efficiency so that we don't even have the disposable culture anymore. You know, disposable items and disposable culture lead to us disposing of people and having disposable people. And I think anyone who's homeless, underclass, or poor can relate to that feeling of being disposable. Because as far as capital is concerned, half of us are disposable. The economy doesn't need us. It doesn't need the unemployed. It doesn't need people who are underemployed. So many jobs are bull jobs. You know, standing around, sitting around, you know, the work hours, you know, the stats bear this out. And so I'll leave this segment with the meme, the phrase that there is no ethical consumption under capitalism. You know, you can change all of your energy sources to renewables. You can buy all organic food, local and what have you. But as long as it's in a system that's geared towards profit making and accumulating money instead of accumulating human potential, it's not good for us. It's not ethical. Because even eating better requires an example of quinoa. You know, superfood quinoa is only grown mostly in Chile. And in order to produce the quantities that are bought in Whole Foods and by middle-class liberals, there are farmers that have to be exploited. I mean, in capitalism, somebody has to be exploited. In liberal economics usually assumes that any economic trade is going to benefit both people, right? But it's a competition with winners and losers. And in most cases, it's all about who can lose the least, who can win the most, and that means someone is being exploited. And we have whole classes of people who are exploited. Exploited doesn't mean, is not a synonym of oppressed, because one can still be very rich, but also still be exploited. You know, you become socially isolated. There's negatives. And like say a rich football player, still an exploited worker, because they have to bargain for the salary and the work schedule and all of that. And of course, it's still, they can be fired. And then, you know, what kind of rights do they really have? Welcome back to Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, broadcasting live from Grand Street Community Arts. Station is WCAALP, The Voice. I have a voice in Albany. And I'm going to use my voice to discuss now. So in the last other side of the break, which was very short, but let's review here. I reviewed how the point, there is no ethical consumption under capitalism. No matter what kind of consuming you're doing it in a process, a system that is exploiting others. It doesn't matter what it is. And there are some examples of, let's say, exceptions. Let's say it's a co-op, you know, worker-owned, sets their own wages, but they're still competing in capitalism, which means they still have to maybe cut some corners. Our local co-op here in Albany has had to take on a bit of a corporate culture to grow and compete with its with the other grocery stores. And they also charge a lot. You know, they have very high prices, which means that only a certain clientele, you know, you can't be poor and shop there. And so there's always going to be a lining, even if it's an exception and you're trying to be as non-capitalist as possible. Like a B Corp is a type of legal entity that is a corporation but is under less legal obligation to pay back dividends and what have you. It's better, but it's almost like nicer slavery. And that's kind of, it's an argument made against any kind of reformism. To reform a current system, we just need more regulations, nicer capitalism, capitalism with harm reduction. But you got to ask, why is there harm? There's all this harm. Harm to the poor. You ask questions like, why are there poor people? Why does poverty exist in the first place, this growing inequality? Why does environmental degradation have to exist? These are very, you know, basic but very serious questions that one can talk for hours about. So I'm just going to summarize really lightly here that we have a system that is actually very rational. It was very rational at one time, and capitalism is very good at creating infrastructure, industrial infrastructure, the infrastructure of our cities and whatnot. But now that we have it, we can transition towards making it more humane. Just as the, you know, mercantile empires of the Age of Exploration were founded, and of course our own country, our wealth and power is based on slavery, actual chattel slavery. And it was a big fight to get rid of it, but then you just transition to the nicer slavery of wage slavery, working for wages and whatnot. where one can still be tied to place. You know, let's say you're tied to your health, whether you get health care or not. And there's exploitation. So what does this have to do with ecology and environmentalism, of course? Well, I've mentioned exploitation of the environment is paramount. In fact, it's probably like the most fundamental, you know, thinking that you can exploit and extract from the land, as you will, kind of gives you the mindset to extract and brutalize people. Like the ultimate hierarchy is this little kind of old meme, a chart of sorts, where it's like the boss yells at the man comes home and yells at his wife, the wife then yells at the child, and the child yells at the dog. That's hierarchy in action. Always someone lower to pick on. And being someone who was heavily bullied in my time, and someone who goes catatonic whenever I'm bullied now by anyone, I'm like, okay, I'm an adult, I can just leave, or prepare to leave, because unlike high school, where, you know, one can't leave, you have to keep going back. But if it's a job and I'm bullied there, I'm not, I'm going to make plans to quit. So we have a duty to act. So, okay, back up. So I mentioned earlier in the show, briefly, that we have like 12 years to act on climate change. What do I mean by that? So let's say it was a reality that 20 years ago, climate scientists were saying, you know, we need to act by 2020, 2030 to mitigate climate change. Like we need to stop. If we reverse things now, and now is 20, like 08, 05, what have you. You know, when An Inconvenient Truth came out, I forget the year, but like let's say that year is the linchpin for the arguments being made that if we do not act, we will see over 1 degree temperature rise. And that will cause all kinds of problems. If we don't act in that time, it could go up to 2 degrees Celsius. And 2 degrees Celsius is the tipping point where then we can't know what will happen and it will be complete catastrophe. We are already at 1 degree Celsius. So the warnings were not heeded because we have a system that self-perpetuates and does quite a lot to defend itself against the kind of massive change that would be required to be sustainable. Sustainable as far as energy and not pollute and not exploit. It has to exploit. To say like, well, we need to stop putting carbon in the atmosphere is to basically tell a capitalist to stop exploiting people. It just can't happen. They would cease to be a business as it is. So there needs to be more radical action because time has passed. It's 2018 and almost 2019 now. And a UN report, you know, I did cover this in a previous episode a month or two ago when it came out. The UN scientists, you know, climate scientists in general, are saying, you know, we have 12 years or it's too late and we have complete catastrophe. We will have collapse. I mean, you could say America is already in decline. The inequality we have, it's a pattern. It's a pattern that shows up historically. And you know, with these kind of, you know, it can still keep going. But then if it gets hit with a shock, like an environmental catastrophe, like, you know, we get multiple hurricanes or big hurricane every year. I mean, the federal government's already saying, like, we're not going to pay for cleanup damage. You know, we have no money to actually react to these disasters anymore. That's what it's saying anyway. Obviously, there's tons of money, but it's all being hoarded. So, and they've got all the guns. By that, I mean the organized violence, the police, the military, the National Guard. So here's a story from The Guardian. In the last 10 minutes of the hour. We have a duty to act. Hundreds ready to go to jail over climate crisis. So legislation isn't going to really do it. It's not going to be fast enough. You really just got to actually fight and be more guerrilla style about stopping the pollution, stopping the exploitation of the planet. So here's a group of people who are stepping up. Because when it comes to peaceful revolution, nonviolent and what have you, here is a call for mass civil disobedience. Civil disobedience does refer to law breaking, but just without breaking anything. But Here we go. To bypass the government's inaction and defend life itself, Rohan Williams calls for mass civil disobedience. A new group of concerned citizens is planning a campaign of mass civil disobedience starting next month and promises it has hundreds of people, from teenagers to pensioners, ready to get arrested in an effort to draw attention to the unfolding climate emergency. The group, called Extinction Rebellion, is today backed by almost 100 senior academics from across the UK. The Guardian is a UK publication, so this is specifically in Britain. In a letter published in The Guardian, but by the way, similar groups do exist in America. In a letter published in The Guardian, they say the failure of politicians to tackle climate breakdown and the growing extinction crisis, because mass extinction is underway, it just hasn't hit humanity yet. But it's scary to think about and makes you very lethargic, perhaps, that it's already too late. But that is why the action needs to become more direct. You know, you can't buy your way to happiness and you can't buy your way to justice. In a letter published in The Guardian, they say the failure of politicians to tackle climate breakdown means the social contract has been broken. It is therefore not only our right, but our moral duty to bypass the government's inaction and flagrant dereliction of duty to rebel and defend life itself. Those behind Extinction Rebellion say that almost 500 people have signed up to be arrested and that they plan to bring large sections of London to a standstill next month in a campaign of peaceful massive disobedience. So these are sit-in protests, blocking traffic, I suppose, blocking highways like Black Lives Matter. It really hits the capitalists where it hurts, in the wallet, because cable news sources will usually list how many dollars were lost in the lost business that wasn't able to be done. Roger Hallam, one of the founders of the campaign, said that it was calling on the government to reduce carbon emissions to zero by 2025. Pretty steep goal, but it's the goal we need to have. Establish a citizens' assembly, a more democratic government, to devise an emergency plan of action similar to that seen during the Second World War. On top of the specific demands, Hallam said he hoped the campaign is respectful of disruption, but would change the debate around climate breakdown and signal those in power. The planet is an ecological crisis. We are in the midst of a sixth mass extinction event on this planet. Children alive today in the UK will face the terrible consequences of inaction, from floods, wildfires, extreme weather, crop failures, and the inevitable breakdown of society. We have a duty to act. Of course, the society that creates this kind of chaos and destruction, I have to wonder, is a society worth preserving. But the whole point of having mass disobedience, changing government, is to change society, to transform it into something that is not exploitative. Something that, in my opinion, needs to be more socialist and anarchistic. You know, more democratic, it means more direct government, and more socialist, as in more commonly held resources that are managed by people, by communities, who have an interest not to pollute themselves. And, when in real federations, would have an incentive to not pollute their neighbors. At the moment, there is no disincentive to pollute your neighbors. You can pollute the poor neighborhood and get away with it completely. It's what happens. There's no law stopping you from doing it. Maybe there has been zoning put in place and laws to, you know, move pollution outside of cities, but more or less just away from white people. Hundreds of people have gathered in libraries, meeting halls, and cafes to hear dire warnings about the consequences and what they can do about it. It feels like we are tapping into something very powerful in terms of frustration and urgency many people are feeling as the evidence mounts of the scale of the climate emergency we are facing, says Hallam, an academic at King's College who specializes in social change and protest. He said the group was now getting 20 requests a week from people across the UK wanting to be given a talk. His talk on social change and what we can really do about it besides buying green, which is a complete myth. The attempt to organize wide-scale civil disobedience looking around the looming breakdown is just weeks after three people were jailed and then released for an anti-fracking campaigns in the UK. And it follows dire warnings from the UN that there are only 12 years left to prevent global ecological disaster. Almost 100 academics, half of them professors, on Friday backed the call for rebellion. Peaceful rebellion, as it were. In a letter to the Guardian, they state, while our academic perspectives and expertise may differ, we are united on this one point. We will not tolerate the failure of this or any other government to take robust and emergency action in respect to the worsening crisis. The science is clear. The facts are incontrovertible, and it is unconscionable to us that our children and grandchildren should have to bear the terrifying brunt of an unprecedented disaster of our own making. None of this is hypothetical anymore. You know, half of California is on fire. We do have stronger hurricanes. You know, New York has been flooded several times in the last decade. And our winters are getting later and later. And, you know, people just kind of joke about it. Joke about how, you know, oh, it's warm in November and October. It used to snow. We used to, you know, our winters would start October, November, and they last till March at the latest. Now, we've gotten snow in April. Basically winter doesn't start till November, Thanksgiving. You know, it's just got cold here. We just had some snow, a nor'easter, as it were. But, you know, the climate belt is crazy. It's all kinds of not working. And so as we get polar vortexes, we get these shifts all year long. It's been these succession of shifts of like a few days where it's hot and a few days where it's cold and a few days, you know, it's totally unbalanced. And it drives people nuts, at least long term. What else can I put at this? Caroline Lucas, the Green Party MP, is also supporting the plan and will be among the speakers at the launch of Parliament in Parliament next week. This is why it's good to have their parties around, because then they can act as government liaisons to say, you know, that people on the inside. A few people on the inside can make a lot of difference, as anyone who's boosting our Cortez can say she's bringing up these issues. But Hallam remains undeterred. As part of our attempt to mobilize a wider environmental movement, activists from Extinction Rebellion, armed with flowers and letters, occupied Greenpeace headquarters last week, describing the move as a tap on the shoulder of a friend. context, Greenpeace has become quite a compromised organization and doesn't really do a good job for what they used to do. They wanted the environmental organization to email its members highlighting the rebellion plan and ideally calling on them to take part, because they were refusing to do so. After 2 hours of friendly discussions, the group left. Greenpeace subsequently said that although it supports any attempt to raise awareness of the climate emergency, it does not know enough about those behind Extinction Rebellion to ask its members to take part. Well, why don't they just talk and know them then? It's an excuse. It's just an excuse. But Hallam remains undeterred. The planned rebellion will begin with a declaration of demands. And basically, it's like a small strike. Strikes that last a day, a week. In Colombia, students are striking right now. Don't have time to go into it, but their demands are very simple. It's the demands that all students should have: to lower tuitions, to have more student control over colleges, and to not be treated like slaves or hostages. You know, with their, you know, if you organize, you're going to lose your degree, and then you'll be you're in the underclass. And that's always a threat to anyone who wants to make some trouble and assert their rights and dignity.
God damn it. Samurai sauce. Fucking sons of bitches. Go, Clyde.
Get up and out. My belly's full. festival.